teaching out the book of Nehemiah here this evening. So if you will, please open up to chapter 9, actually. I would like to just set the stage again with a couple of verses from chapters 9 and 10. You'll remember last week that after 52 days and much opposition and quite a few adventures and eight different ways that the Gentiles and Samaritans surrounding them had tried to defeat the rebuilding of these walls, Nehemiah has been phenomenally successful in only 52 days, has succeeded in encompassing the perimeter of Jerusalem as it was in the 400s BC, much smaller than it would become later, of course. But nonetheless, reestablishing after the 70 years of Babylonian captivity and even later in a total of three waves of returning exiles, they have succeeded. They are still yet, you know, as Nehemiah prayed, slaves from the standpoint that Medo-Persia is the great superpower of their time. They still must pay their taxes. They're still subject to the vagaries and decisions, you know, of those Medo-Persian kings. But still yet, they're home. And all who wished after the captivity have been allowed to return. And all who came have been extremely busy in these years now, reestablishing what will be now that last presence of the Jews in that promised land until the coming of the Messiah. And so in Nehemiah chapter 9, and looking at just the last verse of that ninth chapter, he summarizes by saying, "Because of all this, we are making an agreement in writing, and on the sealed document are the names of our leaders, our Levites, and our priests." So the secular leadership, which would, of course, include Nehemiah and Ezra at this time, the Levites, which is the tribe that has responsibility for all things related to the temple, and the priests, who particularly from among the Levites, offer the sacrifices, that these people, along with the hearty agreement of the entire nation, have just recently completed a public reading of the law. They have been moved first to tears and then told that they should abide in joy because of these circumstances. But they are solemnly vowing and sealing it in a document that they will be faithful to their God. So again, if you'll turn to chapter 10 and look at verses 28 through 30, the last chapter we considered last week, in 28 through 30, then, the rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, the temple servants, all those who had separated themselves from the peoples of the lands to the law of God, their wives, their sons, and their daughters, all those who had knowledge and understanding, are joining with their kinsmen, their nobles, and are taking on themselves a curse and an oath to walk in God's law, which was given through Moses, God's servant, and to keep and to observe all the commandments of God our Lord and His ordinances and His statutes, and that we will not give our daughters to the peoples of the land or take their daughters for our sons." That's the first statement. And then you can scan down to the end of that chapter. We read it last week. There's a list of various oaths that they are taking, all of which revolve around the proper temple service and simply being what God would have them be and doing what they are to do. And so as we closed out last week, we have this wondrous event going on, an event that lasted for more than a week, all of which is the rededication of not just the temple. It's not just, oh, glory be, we got, you know, a new building, which they'd completed some years before, or how very grateful we are, you know, that we have a city and houses. No, we even have a wall to defend ourselves against all the people, so we are going to be really, really serious. Would that we, all of us then, had a similar mind, despite the fact, of course, that Jesus made the comment that we should not take any oaths at all. It is commonly misunderstood to be a complete prohibition. The taking of oaths is permissible, whether under the old law or the new. But it is, and should be, such an extremely solemn, important kind of a thing that you would very rarely engage in one. But again, would that we, each of us, at least had the mind for that kind of a commitment. Absolute dedication. May I be cursed by God if I don't obey His commands. Now, I was speaking with Sabre here just a few minutes ago. She'd done some research as a result of one of the questions that arose last week about bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs, one for the girls at age 12 for the girls and 13 for the boys. This is what she was discovering in her work here this last week. But it's a similar kind of a thing that the Jews are doing to this day, trying to impress their either 12 or 13 year olds that you have come of age and that you are now a son or a daughter of the what? What did mitzvah mean? Son or daughter of the commandments. So as we've just been reading, it's about the commandments. They're rehearsing these commandments. They've had it publicly read to them, took hours while they were assembled to hear every word from these five books of the law of Moses. These people are dedicating themselves under penalty of a curse from God, taking the solemn oath that they will be children of the covenant, of the commandments of their God. This, of course, is exactly what we also are doing the day that we're baptized into Christ, rededicating ourselves as well. So apparently, high upon the wall that they've just finished, in a gigantic courtyard and meeting area that would be, you know, just inside this law, they set up, you know, the wooden podium. They had all the the highest leaders, you know, present. Ezra reads for hours, and these people, they're serious. Now, this continues in chapters 11 and 12 and 13. In 11, in the first six verses, now the leaders of the people lived in Jerusalem, but the rest of the people cast lots to bring one out of ten to live in Jerusalem, the holy city, while nine-tenths remained in the other cities. And the people blessed all the men who volunteered to live in Jerusalem. Now these are the heads of the provinces who lived in Jerusalem. But in the cities of Judah, each lived on his own property in their cities. The Israelites, the priests, the Levites, the temple servants, and the descendants of Solomon's servants. And some of the sons of Judah and some of the sons of Benjamin lived in Jerusalem. From the sons of Judah, now here comes another list, and we've had several already, and I'm not going to read down through that list. But coming down to verse 6, all the sons of Perez who lived in Jerusalem were 468 able men. Now, just attached to this, and maybe get your pencil out, at verse 19, after reading through all these, you know, subsequent names and given numbers, in verse 19, also the gatekeepers, Jacob, Talman, their brethren, who kept watch at the gates were 172. The total of the numbers that are given, starting with verse 6's 468, and ending down there with the 172 gatekeepers, the total that is given in those verses is 3,044. 3,044. So a determination was made. We have a walled capital city with a fully functional temple and all of the Levites and the priests in place. We have singers, we have musicians,
We are 100% now fully functional. One out of ten will be chosen through volunteers and lots to live in the city. Nine-tenths of Israel will be living out and about, scattered across the land flowing with milk and honey. Now, much like, you know, it might be today, I don't know, everybody has their preferences, I guess, but you know, which would you prefer? Which, no matter how beautiful a city is, a city that has a wall around it is automatically what? Kind of cramped. And, you know, not the greatest view. You've got a small area with a really serious wall. So you're down inside, you know, what you see is walls of houses and whatnot. Israel is a beautiful country. I've spent a lot of time in the city of Jerusalem, inside the walls of the old city of Jerusalem, having my pick, which place would you live? There's just so many places you can live in Israel with vast and expansive views, you know. Just, it's wonderfully beautiful. And, you know, I wouldn't want to live in the city all the time. It's interesting. I've enjoyed my time there, but I don't live in the city all the time. And so they're blessing and appreciating the people who, by means of the volunteering and the lots, 10% of Israel are going to be fully inside the city, which means that if an invasion comes, we already have people in place with all kinds of storehouses full, weapons at the ready, trained to defend our city. And when the invasion comes from north or south, because in Israel's case, the lay of the land is such that mostly, you know, those are the only two choices. Can't come from the Mediterranean too well. There were seagoing vessels, couldn't come from the desert too much. You know, you'd expect north or south. But at any rate, if these invasions come, what are all the outlying residents of those cities going to do? Abandon their fields and everything and run to Jerusalem, where 10% have been living in readiness to keep the temple fully functional, be prepared for any kind of an invasion, make sure that these new walls, and it's 10 gates, so there's a total of 12 in the end, you know, are all, you know, ready for whatever assails us. And so when these people vowed at 9:38 and the last part of chapter 10 there, that they were going to serve their God for at least 10% of them, that took over their lives. They were not free to just roam around and pick, you know, the prettiest place to build a house. They came and they lived in the city. Now, it's okay. You know, the city's not terrible, but it wouldn't be as enjoyable as anywhere else. And so, good for them. They're appreciated and they're named. And there's 3,044. Now, I take this, I believe what happens is you have 3,044 of the individual men who are named. Their wives and children, you know, would certainly be there in attendance with them. And this does not mean that they are not allowed to own a farm or a field, you know, in various other parts of the land. It just meant that they were coming here to this city on a full-time basis. They still could have the rest going on, you know, but the vast majority of the time we're in the city there. So you've got 3,044. Is that a really big city? If you double it, we say every man is married. We've got 6,088. Is that a really big city? Well, really not. So we give each couple, we're back to the 3,044 couples, 10 kids. How many have we got? 34,000. Is that a big city? No, it's really not. You know, but These, let's call it outside, you know, 34,000 people are living in the brand new fortified Jerusalem. All right, now, I skip down verses 22 through 24. In chapter 11, the overseer of the Levites in Jerusalem was Uzi, however they pronounced it, the son of Bani, son of Hashabiah, son of Natani, son of Micah, from the sons of Asaph, who were the singers for the service of the house of God. For there was a commandment from the king concerning them, and a firm regulation for the song leaders day by day.
And Pethahiah, son of Meshezabel, of the sons of Zerah, son of Judah, was the king's representative in all matters concerning the people. So we have a secular government, we have a religious government, we have a fully functional city by the time we get into chapter 11. So, aha! We'll never have another problem, right? It was a wondrous moment in Israel's history. And they meant it with all their hearts, I think, to every man and woman. But how long does it take for people to forget even written oaths in which they have invoked curses, you know, from God if they fail? What has been the history of Jewish faithfulness throughout the Old Testament to this time? You know, yeah, at best it's a generational and a cyclical kind of thing. It's just always going around, rising and falling. That's the way that it's always been. So let's move our way into then chapter 12. In chapter 12 and verse 1, these are the priests and the Levites who came up with Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, Sariah, Jeremiah, and Ezra, etc. Another long list. I truly do think we'll get done early tonight because we get to skip, you know, an awful lot of verses right here. But Zerubbabel is the first man that's named in verse 1. Ezra is the last man named in verse 1. Zerubbabel was governor in the first return. Ezra came back in the second return. Nehemiah in a third return. And so we've had all three of these men now that we've been studying for several weeks. These are priests and Levites specifically in chapter 12 as we get started here and skip down now to 22 and as you can see to the end of the chapter. So starting in 22, as for the Levites, the heads of fathers' households were registered in the days of Eliashib, Joiada, Johanan, and Jaddua, etc. 23, sons of Levi, heads of fathers' households, were registered in the book of the Chronicles up to the days of Johanan, son of Eliashib. And the heads of the Levites were, and here we go again, their brothers or names prescribed though in 24, to give praise and thanks as prescribed by David the man of God, division corresponding to division. As you go back in the preceding history, if this is the 400s BC, David was living 600 years ago. 600 years ago, David was renowned for a lot of things, but one of them that involves temple worship is what? Musicianship and song crafting. And he had set up a system, a highly organized system, a rotating system on how the priests, the Levites, the singers, and all these, you know, were going to be functioning. This is in the records. And so the people now are looking back 600 years ago. We had a wondrous, the pinnacle of our success, the days of David and Solomon. And they just want so badly to get back to that glory again. So they are resurrecting now all of the different courses. When you get to the New Testament and Zechariah has to go into, you know, the temple according to his course. It's all about David's organizational system. So here it is being re-established here in chapter 12. Now, skipping down to 27, at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they sought out the Levites from all their places to bring them to Jerusalem so that they might celebrate the dedication with gladness, with hymns of thanksgiving, with songs, cymbals, harps, and lyres. So the sons of the singers were assembled from the district around Jerusalem, from the village of the Netophathites and Beth Gilgal, etc. And in 30, the priests and the Levites purified themselves. They also purified the people, the gates, and the wall. So what now are they doing
that is something in addition to the big assembly for the reading of the law, the rededication of the people, the signing of the oath. What are they now doing that is not taking place in one place? They are making the circuit of the city walls and standing before God and invoking His blessing at every one of 12 gates. These are the entrances, you know, by which we come in and go out from our city. These will be the most important defensive positions for our city. And so they then go and have the singers, you know, and an entire ceremony, gate by gate by gate by gate, for a total of 12 times. They are, in verse 30 as well, purifying themselves and the people, as well as these gates and the wall. So this is just an enormous, you know, ceremonial event that goes on and on and on and on. Raise your hand if you at least turned on for a few minutes of today's burial service of Herbert Walker Bush, 41st President of the United States, who passed away on Friday, had all, you know, the funeral in several different places, you know, here today. Well, we all of us, you know, probably seen a little bit of that. Was it grand? Yeah, it was grand. Was it impressive and moving? You know, all of that. Took place in a number of different places. Here, it was a perfect picture today, where you have thousands of people involved in a lot of planning, and then you have your band over here doing the singing. We saw that when the body came down out of the rotunda. You know, they had a whole band in one location. You know, this is the very kind of thing they're doing all around the entire circumference of this city of Jerusalem. Think how neat it would have been just to be there, okay? Your thoughts of how here we are in the presence of our God, in the city of our God, with the temple of our God, to defend ourselves from the people who are not of our God, and we want to touch every single aspect of everything that we've built and done, and dedicate ourselves in purity and the things that we've built to the service of our King.
Could it also be like the dedication is like an anointing, making the walls holy, making the gates holy in the dedication, so that they're specially set aside and all?
That's exactly what's taking place. That's just different words for precisely, you know, what we've been saying. Setting this aside for us, right? No, for God. It's not for us. We did a lot of work. We're going to have 10% of our entire population living here. That 10% is going to be involved in a whole lot of activities to keep the worship and the sacrifices, you know, in place. But it's all about separating ourselves, rededicating ourselves, purifying ourselves for that purpose. It's exactly what that is. So every aspect of it. Then, coming down to verse 31, then I had the leaders of Judah come up on top of the wall, and I appointed two great choirs, the first proceeding to the right on top of the wall toward the refuse gate. So, you know, all of those are named. 37, at the fountain gate, they went directly up the steps of the city of David by the stairway of the wall above the house of David to the water gate on the east. Now, you know, I appreciate it, brother. I understand it. You know, I really do. That, you know, for most people, you just think, well, so what? You know, but God wanted it recorded. There's a tremendous amount of geographical information. He at least wants us to appreciate something of the scope of what's going on here. So, I didn't bring you pictures tonight. I'll throw it again. I've done it with you dozens and dozens of times. But Fountain Gate, up the steps of the city of David, was the city of David on the north, south, east, or west of the Temple Mount. It was on the south. Was it uphill or downhill? It was downhill. And even in those days, what had they done on the south side as you go uphill to the Temple Mount walls itself? There was a giant ceremonial staircase that lay between David's palace and all the rebuilding that's going on now for that. Nehemiah staying in that same area. Then they would go uphill What are the Psalms of Ascent that David and others had written 600 years ago? What were the Psalms of Ascent about? How were they used? So on those steps, apparently, I did a whole lesson on this when we were back in the book of Psalms. You have this whole collection of Psalms that are called Psalms of Ascent. And apparently they were specifically designed 600 years before these events for people to be composing themselves and preparing themselves in mind and body, passing through full immersion baptistries, and then coming up, you know, these ceremonial stairs, all with a view to forever looking up until they got all the way onto the Temple Mount itself, singing these psalms and reciting and reading these psalms on these steps, on these psalms of ascent. So you can see that the ceremony is just extremely involved, and it would be very compelling, very moving as they're going through this, and the Lord wanted us to know about it, gives us specific insight. So these places have been located and can be found, and you can go in at least and stand upon them to this day. Now in 38, though, the second choir proceeded to the left, while I followed them with half the people on the wall above the Tower of Furnaces to the broad wall. Hezekiah's broad wall has been discovered. There's only a little bit of it you can see in an excavation down in the pit right there, but still to this day, pretty impressive. And the second choir proceeded to the left, half the people on the wall above the Tower of Furnaces to that broad wall, above the gate 39 of Ephraim, by the old gate, by the fish gate, the Tower of Hananel, Tower of the Hundreds, far as the sheep gate, they stopped to the gate of the guard. Then the two choirs took their stand in the house of God. So did I and half of the officials with me. So very apparent, we have Nehemiah describing all of this. And what they did was they took this huge number of singers, these two choirs, and they've just built a wall around the entire circumference of the city. So they start at the south end, and they split the choirs and apparently go up the walls on both sides, and then they're going to come to the very top, which is where Mount Zion is, and the temple itself has been placed. They're going to come back together there in this gargantuan ceremonial event. So in 40, the two choirs took their stand in the house of God, and so did I, to be Nehemiah, and half the officials with me. Verse 43. Now they're singing in 42. And in 43, on that day, they offered great sacrifices, rejoiced because God had given them great joy. Even the women and children rejoiced, so that the joy of Jerusalem was heard, what? From afar. They are singing their lungs out. And they've got apparently hundreds of people who are professional singers who've been planning this for the longest time. And they are on this ridgeline with the Valley of Gehenna over there on the west, the Kidron Valley on the east. They're ascending this ridgeline and then coming up to the very top where they're in the presence of the temple itself. And the choirs are singing, the people are singing, they're dedicating walls. It was a fabulous moment in history. Would only that it would stick. Okay, so you know what's coming in that 13th chapter. So, great sacrifices, enormous joy. 44, on that day men were also appointed over the chambers for the stores, the contributions, the first fruits, the tithes, to gather into them from the fields of the cities the portions required by the law for the priests and Levites. For Judah rejoiced over the priests and the Levites who served, for they performed the worship of their God in the service of purification, together with the singers and the gatekeepers, in accordance with the command of David and his son Solomon. We are resuming a 600-year-old tradition. In the days of David, verse 46, and Asaph, we have Psalms of Asaph to this day recorded in the book of Psalms. In the days of David and Asaph, in ancient times, there were leaders of the singers, songs of praise, hymns of thanksgiving to God. And so all Israel, in the days of Zerubbabel and Nehemiah, gave the portions due the singers and the gatekeepers as each day required, set apart the consecrated portion for the Levites, and the Levites set apart the consecrated portion for the sons of Aaron. The whole tithing system to fund all of this is also in place and fully functional. So that brings us to our final chapter. And we'll start with the 13th chapter, then the first 9 verses. On that day, dedication of the walls day, they read aloud from the book of Moses in the hearing of the people. And there was found written in it that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever enter the assembly of God, because they did not meet the sons of Israel with bread and water, but hired Balaam against them to curse them. However, our God turned the curse into a blessing. So it came about that when they heard the law, they excluded all foreigners from Israel. Now, where do the Samaritans come from? The intermarrying of Jews and Gentiles throughout the period of how many years that Jeremiah had prophesied in chapter 25 that the people would be punished in exile in Babylon? 70 years. And a whole new, race or group of people arose. Now, these people have been well established in that land for a long time. In fact, it's, 80 or 90 years since the first return. So and that was after the 70. So, 150 years. These people have been living in the land and intermingled. Why do you think Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem, earlier in this book, were so upset? The first time they had a confrontation with Nehemiah, what did he say? You have no part or lot, to use Acts 8's terminology, in this matter. This is for us and not you. Now, brother, that's hard. You take a people, this is their homeland, and has been for over 100 years. They think of themselves, sort of, as being tied to Jehovah, but they are not what Jehovah's original laws said. And now, even though they are woven into the fabric of this society, what are we going to do? We're going to separate them. Painful, difficult as this is, we're going to do it God's way. This will always be true for you as well. When anybody comes back to God, will you have entanglements in the world? Sure. You've been living this unfaithful life. You've got all this stuff in place. It was the natural order of things. Then you start reading in the law. Now, Ezra read earlier, they're doing it again now as they're dedicating the law. And again, they're finding parts, that they just hadn't implemented yet. So now, we're going to take care of this business. So, they separated these people in these first 3 verses. Verse 4 tells us the consequences. Prior to this, Eliashib the priest, who was appointed over the chambers of the house of our God, where they kept all the stuff. Thank you. all of the means to perform these sacrifices. Eliashib, he was appointed over the chambers. He's the guy that decided where everything went. We're going to have the wine over here. We're going to have the oil over there. We're going to have the wheat over here. The meat and the offerings. All these things are going to be in these various places. This Eliashib, that was his job, but he was related at the end of verse 4 to who? Tobiah and Sanballat were the first two guys to rise up and fight against Nehemiah. They're the ones that get told to their faces, first thing out of the box, you guys don't belong here anymore, and we're going to not involve you. So in verse 5, he's related to Tobiah, and this Eliashib had prepared a large room for him, where formerly they put the grain offerings, the frankincense, the utensils, and the tithes, grain, wine, oil, prescribed for the Levites, singers, and gatekeepers, and contributions for the priests. But during all this time, I was not in Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had gone to the king. After some time, however, I asked leave from the king, and I came to Jerusalem and learned about the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah by preparing a room for him in the courts of the house of God. You know, it was very displeasing to me. So I threw all of Tobiah's household goods out of the room. And I gave an order that cleansed the rooms. I returned there the utensils of the house of God with the grain offering and the frankincense. So, apparently, and this is just such an oblique, you know, off the hand reference, and it is a bit of a struggle to quite understand. You know, so some would think that Nehemiah is talking about the first time, but it looks more like it's the second time. Apparently, after his first request, why is your countenance sad, Nehemiah? Well, you know, my brother says the walls are broken down. Well, what do you want? Well, I want to go back and rebuild it. So after all of that, at some point, Nehemiah had returned to Persia. And while that was going on, in the temple and the storehouses and all that had been rebuilt under his leadership, he's not there at this period of time, already, after a signed document, calling down the curses of God, walking the walls and all the choirs and everything, what do we find Eliashib's doing? He's the guy in charge of it all that, you know, that Nehemiah leaves behind. And here he's going to take this Tobiah and give him a room that is anything but appropriate. 10. So, you know, what does he do? I gave an order in verse 9, and what did he do? He has walked in and threw everything Tobiah had right out of there. So, you know, cleansed those rooms, returned the utensils. Well, verse 8 it is, he threw his household goods out and then rededicated. Now 10, I also discovered that the portions of the Levites had not been given them. So we're collecting the tithes, but what are we not doing? Giving it, yeah, distributing it to the people we collected it for. So the Levites and the singers who performed the service had gone away each to his own field. So while we had these volunteers, and we had, you know, these lots, and of course we had the Levites and the priests that had to be in Jerusalem for the temple service, they're not being supported to do it. So they're being forced back out into their fields. Now they're working part-time in the temple, trying to make a living for themselves. 11. So I reprimanded the officials, and I said, "Why is the house of God forsaken?" And I gathered them together and restored them to their posts. All Judah then brought the tithe of the grain, wine, and oil into the storehouses. And in charge of the storehouses, I appointed Shelemiah the priest, Zadok the scribe, Pedaiah of the Levites, and in addition to them was Hanan the son of Zakur, son of Mattaniah. They were considered reliable. It was their task to distribute to their kinsmen. So we got representatives from these various groups, men who are deemed to be trustworthy, and gave them the responsibility that had now formerly been Eliashib's, who had failed miserably in what was probably no more than a few months or a year or so, that Nehemiah would have gone back to report to Artaxerxes. Now, 14. It's interesting how Nehemiah kind of goes back and forth between telling a historical record and then talking to God. I've always enjoyed Fiddler on the Roof. Do you like Fiddler on the Roof? You know how the movie starts? And you've got that conversation going on and the song, you know, tradition and all of that. And then throughout the movie, you know, here is these conversations. Well, look what happens in 14. Without any warning or, you know, setup or explanation, "Remember me for this, oh my God. And do not blot out my loyal deeds which I perform for the house of my God and its services." So he just kind of turns away even from his writing and dedicates it to his God. Reminds God of his efforts and hopes that God will reward him appropriately. 15. "In those days, I saw in Judah some who were treading wine presses on the Sabbath." Good or bad? You know, breaking the Sabbath. "And bringing in sacks of grain and loading them on donkeys." Breaking the Sabbath. "As well as wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of loads. They brought them into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. So I admonished them on the day they sold food. Also, men of Tyre were living there." Jews or Gentiles from Tyre. Gentiles, Lebanon today, were living there, imported fish and all kinds of merchandise and sold them to the sons of Judah on the Sabbath, even in Jerusalem. He's aghast. Then I reprimanded the nobles of Judah and said to them, "What is this evil thing you're doing by profaning the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers do the same, so that our God brought on us and on this city all this trouble? Yet you're adding to the wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath." It came about that just as it grew dark at the gates of Jerusalem before the Sabbath, I commanded that the doors should be shut, that they should not open them until after the Sabbath. Then I stationed some of my servants at the gates that no load should enter on the Sabbath day. Once or twice, the traders and merchants of every kind of merchandise spent the night outside Jerusalem. Then I warned them and said to them, "Why do you spend the night in front of the wall? If you do so again, I will use force against you." From that time on, they did not come on the Sabbath. So, brethren, has anything changed? People are human. We always start off, "I see it clearly. I dedicate myself to, you know, my God." And you mean it. And in the varying degrees of, you know, the wide spectrum of humanity, what can happen starting the next day? Immediately, people start falling away. It's the way that it's always been. Can you imagine Nehemiah's distress? What had he been through to get this city rebuilt, rededicated, sworn with an oath and the curses of God that we'd be faithful, and then, you know, like Moses on the mountain for 40 days, what happens when he comes back down the hill? It's just, you would think, unbelievable. How could anybody? Okay. Now, raise your hand if you've never done the same thing. Oops. Every sin you've ever committed, every selfish thing you've ever done, every moment where you just did something without thinking, you know, we're exactly these people. Brother, what does that tell you? You have to be ever conscious, vigilant, alert, and aware. It will happen every time. You just don't want to be one of the people that it happens to. And if everybody around you says, "Oh yeah, you know, Tobiah, let's give you a prominent room in the temple, you know, and the Levites, they got fields, let them work for a living like everybody else, you know, we're not going to distribute the tithes right here, and, you know, what's it matter, you know, if we carry loads on the Sabbath, and if the, you know, traders want to come in from Tyre, you know, well, we ought to, you know, buy and sell on the Sabbath too, and, you know, and so here's this whole list of things that all these people had just sworn on a written document back in chapter 10 that they were not going to do, they're doing. They need a Savior. Don't we all? And eventually we get one to cover even such sins as these. So, one last comment, and you might want to make a note here with regard to 19, chapter 13, in verse 19, and now I got to run back here and get a particular passage. But give me just a second here, and I'll give you a verse reference to write in the margin there. Okay, hold on just a second. In at verse, I would suggest 19. Is it? Yeah, 19. Please write in your margin, Matthew chapter 24, verse 20. Matthew 24, 20. "Pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on a Sabbath. For then there will be a great tribulation such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall. And unless those days have been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days shall be cut short." Now your local friendly neighborhood Seventh-day Adventist looks at Matthew 24:20 and says, see, Christians have to keep the Sabbath because you want to pray that when the Roman armies invade in 67 AD in response to the Jewish rebellion, that, you know, you'd have to violate the Sabbath to flee the city. Jesus said, flee the city, but you don't want to break the Sabbath. So they make up this whole mythology. Why does it say, pray that your flight not be in the winter or on a Sabbath? Was the whole winter a holy day? No. But it would be more difficult to abandon all your possessions and home and flee off into the Judean hills when the Roman army surrounds Jerusalem if there's snow on the ground. What would be the problem, pray, that it's not on a Sabbath day? Because since Nehemiah, verse 19 of chapter 13, what did the Jews do ever after on Sabbath days to the 12 gates? They locked them. So you want to hope that those Romans don't show up when you need to flee and the gates are locked. Not that it would be a Sabbath, but that the gates are locked. If you could take a donkey out of a pit on the Sabbath, could you save your own life on a Sabbath and flee the city like the Lord said? Yeah, it's not about breaking the Sabbath, but if the gates are locked by armed men who think that that's their responsibility is to not allow anybody in or out, then would you have a very different problem? Yeah, you would. Okay, so this is really important. This verse 19 directly relates to Matthew 24:20, demonstrates, you know, that this idea the Adventists have is just ridiculous on Sabbath keeping. It's got everything to do with just like the winter making circumstances physically difficult. Okay, let's close out the book. So, and we're looking at 22, he does it again. I commanded the Levites that they should purify themselves and come as gatekeepers to sanctify the Sabbath day. For this also remember me, O my God, and have compassion on me according to the greatness of thy loving kindness. So in 14, he makes his prayerful aside to the Lord. At verse 22, he makes his prayerful aside to the Lord. And when was the last time you made a prayerful aside to the Lord? Might have been a while. Maybe we can learn a lesson here too. 23. Those days I also saw that the Jews had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. You've got to be kidding me. Ezra's already been through this. How in the world can people do this? Because, as Sabre said a moment ago, they're human. 24. For their children half spoke the language of Ashdod, and none of them was able to speak the language of Judah, but the language of his own people. A house divided will what? It will fall. It just can't stand. Language barriers, since early in Genesis at the Tower of Babel, you know, have either caused nations to weaken and separate and fall, or in a unified language, to bind them together. Here we go again. So in 25, I contended with them, cursed them, struck some of them, pulled out their hair, made them swear by God, you shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor take of their daughters for your sons or yourselves. What was the document they signed and swore? First line of what we will and will not do was what? This very thing in chapter 10. It doesn't take a year. And here they go. 26. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin regarding these things? Yet among the many nations there was no king like him, and he was loved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, the foreign women caused even him to sin. That's a great argument. You think you're smarter than Solomon? He fouled up this way. You think you're smarter than he is? Don't do this thing. Even Solomon, you know, was in trouble because of this. 27. Do we then hear about you that you've committed all this great evil by acting unfaithfully against our God by marrying foreign women? Even one of the sons of Jehoiada, the son of Eliashib the high priest, was a son-in-law of Sanballat the Horonite. Tobiah and Sanballat, the first two guys to oppose any building. So I drove him away from me. 29. Here comes an aside. Remember them, oh my God, because they've defiled the priesthood, the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites. Thus I purified them from everything foreign and appointed duties for the priests and the Levites, each in his task. I arranged for the supply of wood at appointed times for the first fruits. Remember me, oh my God, for good. Nehemiah's book is done. There'll be only one more Old Testament book, Malachi. We'll look at it next week. We'll be done chronologically with our whole Old Testament. And we'll go back to the beginning with Moses and Leviticus in 2 weeks. Well, it'll be here. Yeah, nope, it won't be here. Eventually, we'll get there. I've got a meeting to do this evening through 19 up in Washington. But apart from that, that's where we're going. Okay, comment or question? Rededicate yourselves, brethren, with all the pomp and glory and circumstance that the Jews did. And then do better than they did. Stay purified. Class dismissed.